this collection were a house, which rooms are the sections?
The last part would be the outdoors. The first part would be probably some of the most intimate space. The kitchen, the bedroom, the places where we really live and maybe sit together and talk, a comfortable couch. The second, quite frankly, is the landscape, the friendly and scary parts of the landscape we see out of the big windows. And the third part would be the beauty we choose to surround ourselves with, so maybe in the more public space in the house. And the fourth part, as I said, would be the outdoors.
Hello and welcome to The Right Question, a radio program and podcast featuring authors from the Western United States. Our funding comes from Humanities Montana and members of Montana Public Radio. I'm Sarah Aronson, talking with former Montana State Poet Laureate Tammy Holland about her collection, What Does Not Return. The poems are breathtaking and travel through intimate spaces and relationships while also carrying us outdoors into the spaces and silence of the prairie. Stay with us. Although poems maybe don't necessarily have to be about anything, there's a clear sense in the first section that there's something autobiographical happening. Can you just explain where that part of the book came from?
Yes. My mother died from Alzheimer's, and in her decline, we went through, as a family, various stages of spending time with her, becoming closer and closer, and eventually she moved in with me, and then we had assisted living. So it was that experience. You know, those are the external details of it, my brothers and I trying to work with the situation, but working with the mind that is coming unraveled is really quite an experience that involves loss of memory, obviously, loss of boundaries, loss in so many ways, but also the imagination fills in. And so it feels very fluid when you draw close to this experience.
It sounds like that must have impacted your writing then.
It did. It was inevitable. I mean, it was the world I was living. And it causes some reflection, because when you're watching somebody's imagination too, you begin to reflect upon your own imagination.
There's a moment in that series of poems where sort of the container breaks open and you write a poem called Nuts.
Yeah.
You're free to give any kind of backstory around this, and then I would love for you to read it.
I do remember, I guess, a specific occasion in the sense that I said it out loud when I was walking away from campus, I think, and I was walking with somebody I didn't really know. I said it out loud, and it sounds horrible, which I perfectly understand, but when you're living this day in and day out, it is, as you suggest, it is a bit of a pressure valve to be able to just say this out loud and then gather yourself and go back in. Yeah. Nuts. I say it out loud, and a stranger startles at this cruelty. I want to tell him it depends on the day. Often I am kind. Sometimes I say loony or wacky. If he could see the losses, the jumble of shadows vine through our lives, how we eat and scheme in the kitchen, how we split the difference to forget.
I was wondering then if this is one of the ways writing serves you and served you during this time of unraveling. To use the Robert Frost quote, that every poem is a momentary stay against the confusion of the world. Did writing help you, support you in that process of caregiving your mom?
Well, I think so. Yes. I mean, not, we could say it was therapeutic, but I don't think that's exactly what it is. It was, in some ways, I felt like I was documenting. I was trying to put into language what this experience was. And then there was a lot of crafting. This particular poem went through many iterations. The last stanza in particular is not what I originally envisioned. I had in mind the way you look through a window and you can see the people standing in the kitchen, but that's not how it turned out. So really, the needs of the poem finally overrode everything else. But the documenting was, I felt, really critical. It was very sad, and it was also fascinating. And it was also, I was able to see sides of this person I had not seen, because before that, her guard was up.
Can you speak to this notion of the needs of a poem?
Oh, yes. I always feel that my role is to really serve the poem. The poem will have its own direction. In order for the poem to work out, it may need something other than what I think I would like to put in it. Uh-huh. And so my role is to try to help that happen so that the poem has what it needs.
How on earth are you able to tell what is yours and what is the poem's?
I don't think I separate it, actually.
Okay.
I mean, obviously, it starts with some impulse, something happens, whatever the spark is, and I run with it. But, you know, ultimately, I want to make a good poem. And so I think of it in terms of what the poem needs, but it's because I want that poem to do well. I want it to be a good poem. And I guess over the years, I've acquired some skill as an editor so I can help make that happen.
In the first section, there's a lot of attention to the body and to rituals of grooming.
Mm-hmm.
What's the symbolism there?
Well, I think as somebody moves towards, we're involved with this our whole lives, right? But we are also generally self-sufficient, and we also are so busy thinking about other things that we may not pay any attention. But as a life draws to its end, the body really becomes central. And the care of the body is really primary, because if you can create a little comfort for somebody as they're going through this process, that's a really significant thing. And so I think that's why the body is so present. I mean, her body was shrinking into something so unbelievably tiny, I didn't know people could live at that weight. Mm-hmm. And it is just the central focus.
There are also references to the Wizard of Oz.
Oh, yeah.
What do those references mean to the speaker of the poems or to you?
Well, I think there are hallucinations sometimes with Alzheimer's and the deterioration of the brain. And I think in part it was a way of explaining it. I thought of the Wizard of Oz, you know, there's Dorothy in her bed with all these loving people surrounding her. But the Tin Man and a lion, those are scary. And so I started playing with Wizard of Oz in that way, of it being more frightening, the sense that all the other people surrounding this person who is in the bed, or the mother who is gradually losing her mind, everybody else seems crazy to her. I think I was playing with it in that way.
The last poem of the section left me breathless. Will you read, She Says?
She says, I was thinking to myself, you know, in here, if I could go anywhere, if I could do anything, I only want you to come through the door.
The other sections have their own tones and themes.
Mm-hmm.
How did the book sections come together for you? Because you circle back around to your mother's passing.
Yeah, she reemerges in various places in the book. Well, I never do anything without having people I trust look at my work. It arrived in four sections when I had a little bit of time in an artist studio. It was loaned to me. And I was able to lay everything out on the floor and walk around it and think it through it. And I moved it into seven sections and arranged and rearranged back to four. And then I think it generally had this kind of pattern. I never fully trust my own work in that I need other eyes. I need other people to see what I'm doing and provide feedback. So I asked the poet Melissa Kwasny to take a look, and she made some really good suggestions about how to arrange the manuscript, moving a few poems around. And there was a particular poem that she said, you know, it really doesn't fit. And it was a sort of last-minute change that I kept trying to make it fit. It didn't. In the 11th hour, more or less, I substituted a different poem, Ferry to Provincetown, and that connected then with other poems that were featured in different parts of the book.
The second section, entitled World of the Eye's Long Gaze, feels like your origin making. Was that a conscious move on your part?
Yes, I think so. I mean, in terms of the way it came together, it was definitely that. The prairie is really complex, and it's gorgeous, and it can be severe. And then we have these nuclear missiles in the prairie, which is something we tend not to think about because it's so hard to think about. It's hard to conceptualize it. I didn't know how many there were, but I was driving back and forth to my mother's house, and I was counting, and I counted 7 or 8. Well, then I started doing research, and there are 200. And I don't know what to do with that information. So I wrote poems, I guess.
I'm so glad you brought that up because I want to spend part of our conversation talking about missiles in the Cold War. But first, will you take us to the prairie and read Girlwise, I Viewed the Prairie?
Sure. Girlwise, I viewed the prairie. Beige blue horizon and the thrill of sunset, violet, velvet, magenta, not just for seconds, but minutes coming and then receding from its own brilliant apex. And I hoped to have it all, the arrival, the going, but mostly I wanted to keep the fury of color in a full sky. And wherever I stood, I was center, reaching out to wrap my eyes in the circumference of the racing earth.
You mentioned landscape as a central feature of this section, and I've asked poet Jennifer Finley how landscape affects her voice, and I want to know for you, Tammy, how did the prairie affect your voice, both as a poet and also just a person?
Well, I think in this poem, you have some of that. There is this expanse. When I was a little girl, I used to boggle my mind thinking, how could I lie down and look up and catch the entire circumference of this sky in my vision? And I couldn't understand why I couldn't catch it all. There's that part, this massive part of it. And then there's another part, which is that in all of this, depending on the year, green or kind of sandy-colored landscape, that there might be these moments of brilliance, like a cactus flower, or you might find an agate or a fossil. So there was this sense also of a sort of treasure hunt of what might be found there. And I think those two things, actually, having to do with perception and this pursuit, this search, have affected much of what I do, actually.
I'm also curious about moments of quiet or silence. There's a line from your poem, Scandinavians in the High Plains, where you write, "This land made us silent. We could endure because that's what we do." What can you say about that line?
Well, I think it does take some endurance, right? You have severe weather. You have social isolation sometimes. You have sometimes a severity of expectation. And, you know, we were farmers. Sometimes the crop gets lost. I remember, you know, working these long harvest days from early, early morning until it was so dark and the moisture of the night settled in so we couldn't cut the grain anymore. So I think that's it. I think that's part of the endurance. But in that kind of hard work and isolation too, sometimes silence is the best policy. So, and it can become a habit. It can be too much sometimes. You know, you can be in love with solitude and solitude can get the best of you. And in some ways that's at the center of this book because of the women who were out there, my aunts and my mother all of them ended up with Alzheimer's. And I think sometimes that it had to do with the social isolation. You spend so much time initially in the house taking care of this whole farming process, but eventually then you get older, and then if that isolation persists, you know, I think it's hard on the mind. I don't know that all of that's in that poem, but...
Sure.
Yeah.
I was going to say that the silence of that section is broken with missiles and B-52s and Russia and Russian thistles and the Cold War. And I really want to know, you know, your instincts around including that material.
Well, it's so bizarre when you think about it, right? I remember fighter jets like just sort of zooming over the house. It's a pretend target.
Right.
And that would happen, or there'd be a big bomber sort of flying low and slow over the house. And we took it for granted because these things just happened. And we knew the missiles were going in and the Cold War was going on and the Russians were supposed to be bad, and it was just part of the fabric that we lived in. And yet, how very strange that fabric is. I mean, we're still coping with all of this, right? We're still coping with all of this in so many ways, but it's like a system that has grown kind of brittle, even more brittle than it was then.
So I was wondering why now? You know, why write these poems or include them now if they were written prior?
These were not written prior. These were written in this last few years. It's been very much on my mind. Mm-hmm. And I think these things have been moving more into the news. And, you know, we have this terrible problem of deteriorating missiles now. And what do you do? On a broader scale, I think I have always been fascinated in where violence comes from, you know, where that instinct to harm comes from. And I think it's really worth exploring, particularly in this age where we deal with terribly violent things, school shootings and so forth, all of the time. And I think we need to understand ourselves and how we have fed these tendencies.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to a conversation with Tammy Holland about her poetry collection, What Does Not Return? I'm Sarah Aronson. This is The Right Question. Our full conversation can be found online at mtpr.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Facebook. You have a poem about school shootings.
Yes. And it was not an actual shooting, but it was a lockdown that I was involved in. And for the 20 minutes that we were in there, we didn't know. The only information we were receiving was that it was real. A lot of texting back and forth with parents, and they were all affirming that the SWAT teams were there and the police cars were there. And, you know, we had already turned the lights off. I was trying to keep people busy. Because what else is there to do? It was quite a strange experience. Really traumatic, I think, for many people.
Yeah, I was wondering.
Yeah, really traumatic, I think.
There's a line in your poem, Arsenal, about the missiles and how they became just the weapon we walked around on our way to growing up. And in thinking about school shootings, Tammy, do you have a sense of today's youth and the weapons that they walk around?
Oh, that's kind of a terrifying question, actually. I mean, I know this is a hugely contentious theme and issue, and I think what I hope for is that we can back away from the things that make us fight over it and really start examining it. What modeling has occurred? What are these weapons for? What is this tendency that we have? I think there are some really interesting proposals out to examine this as a kind of social illness. And I would love to see that happen. I think we need to know so much more and we need a broader perspective.
I'm going to circle back around to you and your mom and grief. Yeah. In the poem Immersion and Release, you talk about germinating with anticipation the skin of your own life. What's the skin of your own life now?
Well, I think it's, I don't know, I feel like everything is starting, which I think we go through stages and, you know, grief is one stage and this book maybe has to do with that. But you come out too, and it's not that you ever stop feeling that loss, but I'm at an age right now where I feel like life is potentially short. There's a lot to do. That means it's exciting. I need to be open and I'm interested in seeing what comes next.
Your third section, like walking near water, does it feels like a return indoors, domestic, and there's something that feels sort of accepting. There's some resignation that I read, but just accepting. I was wondering if you would read us Paper Cranes.
Paper Cranes. It started as a sad day. Sometimes you get more than you want. I settled in. We all settled and expected nothing but haze. Then the colored box arrived, a little square of patterned sheets and cardboard. I lifted the lid and admired the perfect corners. Inside, stacks of color, rows of blue umbrellas, tiny flowers, repetitive wide lines, golden shine and primary pigment. Jane took the first sheet. We watched her fold and fold again until she had a red paper crane. She put it in the center of the floor, then started another. I lifted a sheet from the stack, blue like Mediterranean doorways or water. Every fold she made, I copied. For her, this crane hummed purple. We set them on the floor. The others joined in and watched our folds. The cranes multiplied and colors quadrupled. Some kind of resonance emerged, not jittery but joyful. It became our work. We gave cranes to the people who kept us in beige, to our families. We mailed a box of bright cranes to the mayor, and news people came with their cameras. They asked why we did this. We said, "We're solving it. Watch," we said. "You'll see."
Tammy, before the interview started today, you were telling me that you were working with youth around this poem. What's one of your entry points for talking about this poem?
This poem comes in a part of the book that I think focuses in one way or another on art, color, visual understanding of the world. And I think this poem is about perception and color in the sense that, and it extends to mood, really, and emotion. And I think color is really evocative that way. I think it can thrill us or bore us. And it really starts from that point of kind of boredom and a sense of sameness and perhaps the restlessness that surrounds that. And then color enters the scene, and then it brings these people together and they start learning from each other. And as they place this pile of cranes in the center of their floor, their idea of the place begins to change too. So it becomes a sharing outwards from there to more and more people.
In thinking about color, I feel like the fourth section steals the color and turns into animals.
Yes,
called
absolutely.
No reason to stay inside. You're gesturing out again. And I notice there's a contrast between the dryland prairie and the sea. What's your relationship to the sea?
I love it. I love it, but further, you know, there's that poem, Scandinavians in the Prairie. I think this is a bit of a perplexing question, right? When you have your genetic origins by the sea, by the ocean, and then you move into a dry land, what happens then? That's my interest. There is a kind of push and pull between the two of them, and I love them both. In that particular poem that you mentioned, No Reason to Stay Inside, the sea has come right up to the window, like it's beckoning.
What's your sense of what does happen when you're taken from your, what I've learned to call the primal landscape, and moved into a chosen landscape or a forced landscape?
Yeah. I think your internal landscape doesn't necessarily change. I mean, I think there is a draw, a pull. I always think of it as being sort of genetic. I don't know whether it is or not, but I recently went to Norway, to the place where my grandfather came from, and it's water all around, lakes, ocean, fjords, and wilderness and mountains and farming, and I felt completely at home. I think we miss it. The only other experience I had with this was that I lived in Iowa for a year, and I perpetually looked for mountains. Obviously, they weren't there, right? But there was something in my internal landscape that said there will be mountains on the horizon, because that's the world I've grown up in.
Are you working on poems about your trip to Norway?
In a way, yes. Okay. It's so recent, I don't know, but sure. Yes, I think so.
Sure. The title of your collection is What Does Not Return. Where did it come from?
The poem by that title has to do with giving up the past, I think. One of the central features is this oyster that has died and yet is still in my possession. And then I have to figure out what to do with it. But what intercedes is a whale leaping out of the water, first whale I had ever seen. And the need to let go and be open to what may happen in the moment. Yeah, I think that's where it came from. It seemed appropriate for the themes in this book.
Will you take us out on Blue Moon?
Blue Moon. Startled, you step away and disappear into a shadowed corner. So much velvet to invite you seems inevitable. What is the chance a woman might walk with a deer on this border of pavement? But my heart did jump, and I was willing.
My last question. In what ways do you find yourself willing now?
I feel willing to explore. I don't know. In terms of my writing, I never want to do the same thing that I just did, so I don't know where the new work is going. And I'm following along.
Tammy Holland lives and teaches in Billings, Montana. She's published 3 collections of poetry and served as the Montana Poet Laureate from 2013 to 2015. Look for more information about her and her work at mtpr.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and visit our Facebook page. Many thanks to Humanities Montana for supporting us since 2008. And thanks to you for listening. I'm Sarah Aronson, and this has been The Right Question.
The Right Question is produced by Sarah Aronson, Beth Ann Austin, studio engineer and production assistant. The music in this program was written and performed by John Floridis.